Greetings, my friends. This is Mark Foster from the Newport Beach office of UBS hosting Newport Legacy Insights. I'm actually currently enjoying a beautiful day in Whitefish, Montana. It's a beautiful spring day, March 26th, and I will soon be in the Newport Beach office with the whole team for the majority of April and much of May. Today, our topic is educational. So I'm welcoming you to Econ Class 101, and our guest professor is going to be Andrew Dubinsky. He is our senior UBS economist with our Global Wealth Management Chief Investment Office. What we're going to be discussing today is what creates growth in our money supply, where does inflation come from, and how that affects interest rates and economic growth. All of this becomes a foundation for valuations for pretty much everything, be it your house or be it your fancy watch or stocks and bonds. Basically, how our financial system works. So to begin with, I want to give you a short history of banking, since banks basically have a really significant role in money creation. And this process has been going on longer than I had expected, actually. The earliest banks, the temples of Babylon and Sumer, were actually way back in the years 2000 BC to 1800 BC. So 4,000 years ago, loans came from high priests lending grains and seeds to farmers who would basically plant, and then after they had the harvest, they would pay back these quasi-banks with a 20% interest rate, and they would pay it back actually in grain. In about 1780 BC, there was something called the Code of Hammurabi. I don't know if I'm saying that exactly right, but Hammurabi was a king at the time. And the Code of Hammurabi was a list of rules that applied to their society. And one of these things was actually the eye for an eye concept. You know, everybody understands what that is. Another thing that was created, believe it or not, was interest rate caps. 1780 before Christ, they had laws that regulated banking, and it also defined what was considered collateral. It's hard to believe that these laws went into place 3,775 years ago. It's pretty crazy. Then after that, you had the grain banks of Egypt. Farmers deposited grain and were issued these state-issued written deposits. In essence, they could take these receipts and exchange them for other goods. So this was basically the first example of currency, and that was back in Egypt. If you fast forward about 1,300 years, you fly into Greece. So that was about 400 years BC, still before Christ. And you see basically private entrepreneurs establishing quasi-banks, and they do it at tables at these markets. They took deposits and they exchanged currencies and arranged for book transfers such that these merchants didn't have to carry a crazy amount of coins. After a few hundred years, we come into the Roman period, and the Romans really formalized banking with the institutions, moving the institutions from temples and markets into traditional buildings, the real-life concept of a bank. That created the concept of credits and debits on a mass scale. So now we're getting into real-life banking. Today, the oldest modern bank is in Italy, and it still exists, and it's the Banca Monte dei Paschi di Siena. They opened their doors, believe it or not, in 1472, near the Columbus era. The stone opened the door and gave toasters to everybody who opened accounts, and perhaps they still do. 4,000 years ago, as in 1982, oddly, interest rates were about 20%. By the time we get to Greece and Rome, the rates had dropped from 20% to 10%. And actually, in Roman times, it had dropped down to 8.33%. Rates back then were pretty high because of the risk. It was pretty easy for a borrower to just disappear, or pretty easy to have massive crop failures and have the borrower end up in bankruptcy. Basically, over that 4,000 years, the evolution of banking was from physical commodities like the grain to representative value, in essence, coins like they had in Rome, and to now, basically digital currency. And a primary example of that is your Amex card or your Visa card. The interesting thing is that the relationship between lending and its facilitation of entrepreneurial activity, the business of the time, and frankly, the cost of finance, all has been somewhat consistent for 4,000 years. Why does this matter, you might ask? Well, there's an interesting balance created in this process of access to capital, i.e. loans. Where do we see the effects of the cost of money? Well, we see it in inflation rates, or deflation, in essence. We see it in the rate of GDP growth. We see it in business formation, investor confidence or investor fear. And we see it in assessing valuations. Easy example would be, is it easier to sell your home when interest rates are 2% or 20%? Clearly, home values will be a function of the cost of money. So is everything else, like stocks and like bonds. The lower interest rates, the higher PE ratios get, and bonds become more valuable as well, and vice versa. When I was a kid, the lending institutions of suburbia were the savings and loans. Back then in the 1960s, there were over 6,000 savings and loans. And there basically were government rules that controlled how much interest they could pay. Our local bank was Home Savings and Loan, which was owned and controlled by the Amundsen family. They offered a passbook savings account that paid a rate of 5.25%. That rate was the exact same rate from my first understanding what a bank was until they were consumed by Washington Mutual, which ultimately went under. So for my frame of reference, and also the perspective of most people my age, basically, for us, the idea of a riskless return, in essence, backed by the government, was a 5.25% passbook account. So the assumption is, well, we should easily be able to get 5.25. Today, if you ask an old codger like me, would you lend money to the U.S. government for 10 years at 4.3%? You know, the likely answer is going to be, well, heck no. We old farts have this frame of reference of high growth post-World War II, high birth rates, large families, unions, inflation, rapid wage growth, the creation of suburbia and all that went with it, you know, be it schools or parks or universities. And frankly, 4.3 feels kind of pedestrian when we grew up in a world of a 5.25% passbook account, and CDs were more than that. So today, the world is totally different than it was during our baby boomer years. So as I said in my opening, today I have invited Andrew Dubinsky, the UBS wealth management economist, to discuss all things money. How is money created? What creates inflation? What's a reasonable rate of return? Will our government debt eat us alive? When might that happen if it does? And how all of this is in a unique balance that helps to provide basically the American dream and prosperity for investors and savers and workers as well. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today. You're such a good guy to always be available to me, and I'm really happy to be able to share you with everybody who's going to be listening to this discussion. Like I said earlier, this is like our Econ 101 class, so maybe we can refer to you here and there as the professor. And I guess if you're the professor, and I'm not going to be Marianne, I'm going to be Gilligan today. Let's get this rolling. First off, can we discuss where money actually comes from? Does the government just print this stuff, or how does this work?
No, thank you, Mark, for having me for this discussion. So money comes in a couple different forms, and the government does print some of the stuff, or I should say the Federal Reserve prints we'll call the paper money. We often call that, or the currency in circulation. But a majority of the money, when we talk, when economists think of money, actually comes in other forms. So, for example, we think about the deposits people have at banks or CDs, or even include other similarly liquid assets like money market funds. And that tends to be a much bigger share of money. That's certainly out of the control of the government. That's more in the hands of the private sector. So you have the Fed that controls currency and circulation, and you have the private sector more or less determining other types of money. And then I would describe another bucket of something that's similar to money, but it's not usually included in that, and call it money, you know, aggregates or measures of money. And that's the money that the Fed prints to banks. Those are called reserve credits. And those are the things that are used to settle payments. But it's also a big part of monetary policy. And that's how the Fed has been able to buy bonds and different types of QE programs. And indirectly, that tends to show up in the other types of money that we think about. So if the Fed buys a bond from you or me, it's going to increase our deposits. So doesn't show up in traditional money, but it indirectly will show up there. So we have a bunch of different things that show up in money, but definitely not completely controlled by the government.
In essence, this, I guess it's a misperception, but you know, a lot of my friends seem to think that inflation comes from the government printing too much money. How does inflation play into the creation of money?
Well, inflation and money are definitely linked in a sense that if a government, not necessarily the U.S., prints a ton of money, that will tend to push up the price level. But it's not just, I would say it's not the only factor. And most people think the relationship between money and inflation is pretty unstable. So there's definitely a positive relationship, especially over long periods of time and really large levels. But it moves around a lot in terms of that relationship. One reason is we have regulation that can affect how much money can translate into economic activity. And that's why when it comes to policymakers, they've tended not to focus on the quantity of money, but really the price of money, just in terms of what is the interest rate people are earning on it and just how people might change their economic decisions if they can earn more money or earn less money based on the rate of interest on their money. It's definitely linked, but it tends to be less of a focus for policymakers.
So just so I understand that, you mentioned that the Fed is controlling the demand for money, and you implied that what they do with that money is whether they invest it to get an interest rate of return or something. But isn't there a much bigger effect in terms of the demand for money through bank lending? And isn't that where a lot of this growth in the monetary base comes from?
That's exactly right. So if banks are feeling really risk tolerant, they can make a lot of loans, and those loans tend to turn into other people's deposits. And that in turn can often generate a lot of growth. So there's definitely this relationship between money and growth. What I'm saying is it tends to move around a lot over time. And it's something that we're talking about, something that the Fed really can't directly control, but it can kind of indirectly affect it by raising and lowering interest rates, or indirectly affect it through regulation. But their main tool for thinking about how to influence what's happening in the economy and reducing inflation if it's too high is through interest rate policy. So if inflation is too high, they're going to try to raise interest rates to discourage people from spending and reduce different types of interest rate sensitive activity like housing, and vice versa. If they think inflation is too low, or the other part of their mandate, unemployment's too high, they'll lower interest rates to try to stimulate activity that's very interest rate sensitive. So it definitely will flow through all the banking system, but they're not able to really directly control the money growth, just indirectly through rates.
Let's say hypothetically that they have low interest rates. I would think that would stimulate the economy. And when the economy is stronger, that their tax base expands at a faster rate. So there's, to a certain extent, an incentive to try to stimulate the economy. I guess maybe that's why feds are independent. Somebody has to pull back the reins in case that growth creates some degree of inflation. Is that a reasonable thought process?
Right. The Fed is usually looking for sustainable growth. So for sure, you can lower interest rates and stimulate growth. Often, if you overstimulate, though, you can get bubbles or where you have, which then can in turn lead to some other problems and cause crises down the road. And of course, if we're looking for real or after inflation growth, so something that raises quality of life or spending power that's after inflation. If interest rates are too low and growth's unsustainable, what you'll see is that the prices will start to outpace people's wages and their spending power would decline. They're trying to strike a balance of stimulating growth to the point where unemployment rates are down to a sustainable level without growing bubbles and without causing inflation to go outside of a range where it starts to introduce a lot of, we'll call it distortions, problems where people are thinking a lot about inflation all the time, and it becomes a real big cost in people's lives and businesses' day-to-day decision-making.
That's basically what you refer to as inflation expectations, that when people start worrying about it being too high and they potentially demand higher wages or whatever else, if there's a sense that inflation is going to be a problem, it just begets additional inflation?
Exactly right. When economists think about modeling inflation, they usually think about three components. And you were bringing up the inflation expectations component. So it's something where you or I, we based on our experiences and what we see going on in the economy, we have a view about what inflation is going to be in the foreseeable future. So when we're setting up our contracts, for example, for setting up a contract for wages, or we're setting up a contract for maintaining the service in the elevator in my building, we're often going to have to reflect the rate of expected price changes in the near future. And what usually drives the view of the future is what people have experienced in the past and, you know, how people think about the quality of institutions and placed like an independent bank, central bank, that's going to be in the background trying to offset excesses in either direction. And the other two things that are really going to come into play are, you know, demand conditions. So that could be influenced by fiscal policy or just where's the unemployment rate right now versus what's sustainable. And then supply shocks. Have we been seeing any big changes in energy prices or any big changes, I'll call it bottlenecks related to shipping? And those tend to be factors that can last a year or two, but we tend not to think of them as permanent most of the time. So those are the three things we're always thinking about when we're thinking about what explains inflation today and how we're thinking about it, how it affects things in the future.
Going back to the whole money supply thing, maybe I have an uber simplistic perspective. I'm sure I do, actually, because just listening to you chat today, it seems a lot more complex than I would have been thinking. My thought was the growth in the money is basically a function of three things: private sector demand, like people wanting to buy a new car, get a car loan or something, and then the government annual budget deficit. I mean, they got to sell bonds to cover the deficit. And then the government's non-reoccurring events, let's say, like the Great Financial Crisis in 2008 or the COVID spending and more recently. Is that just too simplistic? And let's say hypothetically, if it's not, what percent do you account to each of those potential demands, you know, or creation of capital?
You're asking, when we think about how do things like government spending, private sector trends, how do they influence the inflation backdrop or influence money growth, just to clear?
Just money growth. I mean, I can't remember. I think I might have been talking to David Lefkowitz, but he made the comment that money supply growth should be about the same as nominal GDP. And if you were going to break that down into the various components, I mean, where's that biggest portion attributable to? Is it the government and their spending, or is it more the private sector demand?
So I definitely would emphasize when we look at money trends over time, they're rising with the economy. And I would definitely emphasize it's really the private sector and the business cycle trends that are driving most of the movement in money. Now, there are some short-term things that can happen with the government issues a bunch of T-bills very quickly. It can absorb money. And if there is a lot of demand for currency, which you often see, for example, around the holidays, that can have some short-term influences on money. But I would say vast majority of the movement in money and those trends are linked to the private sector, and I would say tend to move in line with the overall GDP. And then I would say one other exception would be when the Fed prints a lot of reserve credits to do a QE program, that has a big impact on the level of money. So I would rank it in order of private sector, the Fed, and then I would put the government last if I have to put them in that order.
A minute ago, you mentioned the price of oil being up, and you mentioned the blockade that we're having. Basically, I have two questions on that. One is, sometimes the cure for high prices is high prices. In essence, as stuff gets expensive, then there's less of it consumed. Kind of like if you have avian flu, kill all the birds, and eggs cost $10 a dozen. No one's going to buy eggs, and then ultimately they get the birds back. But in the case of this Iran thing, that's kind of unique. It's kind of different. What the market's doing because of it is it's obviously oil prices are higher. And because oil prices are higher, people are starting to think that inflation could be higher. And if inflation could be higher, then interest rates could be higher. How do you think this all plays out?
It's a great question and certainly been a big driver of interest rates and the expectations for Federal Reserve policy in the near term. So what have we seen? Obviously, we've seen this big increase in the price of oil and different types of petroleum products. And we know that in the U.S., we spend about 2% of consumption on gasoline. And that is going to just directly flow through to measures of inflation. So we're going to go from an environment where inflation measures are, for example, the CPI indices are going to be in the mid twos to 3% or 4% in the near term future, because we're going to have this level shift coming just from gasoline prices. Now, the question is, that's a one-time shift in the level. If oil prices stay high or if oil prices come back down again, it'll retrace. But what we are seeing is the market is interpreting this as something that would delay the Fed cuts. In fact, we've gone from an environment where we had two cuts priced for the end of the year, which we think makes sense, that the Fed want to lower rates to a more neutral rate, something that doesn't stimulate or restrain activity, to now an environment where the market is now expecting no cuts for the foreseeable future. So the market is assuming that this is an inflation shock that could have some persistence that delays for a long time any further adjustments in the policy rate. Our view is this is going to be something that temporarily raises inflation. And then once the year-over-year period lapses, you would see inflation go back to its prior trend, because we're not expecting this to permanently affect inflation expectations. And we can look at the inflation markets to track that. And we and policymakers are going to look at measures of business forecasts for inflation, as well as consumer expectations of inflation, just to see how they move in response to that, just to get a sense of, is it really going to be a one-off, or is it something that does permanently affect people's attitudes? And so that's partly why we're expecting the Fed to wait and see. Our base case is it doesn't have much of a second round effect. That means where it changes people's expectations or causes the prices of a lot of non-energy products to rise. But that's the recent experience, and that's a forecast. But the Fed wants to see it play out before they really are convinced that they can look through it.
Well, when the new Fed guy comes in, the last thing he can say is this is likely to be transitory. That's for sure.
No, that's a word they don't want to use. They're bending over backwards. And certainly that's a factor that's in their decision-making today is that, when you've been wrong for several years, you tend to be more conservative in the other direction.
Yeah, no kidding. Our podcast last month, we chatted with Kevin Dineen, and we were talking about AI. One of the comments that came out of the Wealth Management CIO research was that they thought that AI would cause the unemployment rate to rise, and that ultimately, even if the economy was relatively strong, they would reduce interest rates because of higher unemployment. The follow-on to that, you know, which just hit me today, I was wondering if that's actually the case. Let's say hypothetically that we do see AI replacing a lot of reasonable wage jobs. Is that going to basically erode our tax base and make our deficit problem potentially a little worse?
Right now, when we look at the labor market data, it doesn't look like, in the aggregate sense, there's a lot of displacement from AI. The concern is that rapid adoption of AI, and there's some reduction in labor demand because some people are going to become much more productive and businesses won't necessarily need the same amount of employees to do the same amount of work. And the assumption is the overall effects for growth are positive. There's a range of estimates of how much it could increase growth. But the idea is if the growth effects of AI are net positive, you would expect to actually have a larger tax base. Your forecast for the deficit or tax revenues would shift higher. The tax code tends to be progressive in a way, in that if there's some really big winners, they're going to be paying some higher tax rates. And there are certainly going to be some people that are relative losers. And of course, there's a hope that they're retrained and they re-enter the workforce and perhaps at least learn AI tools. But there is a period of transition where, yeah, the unemployment rate could rise. But I think the overall expectation is it would be good for growth. Good growth is good for the tax base, and might be some winners and losers in that transition period, but I would expect it on net would be positive for growth in the fiscal outlook.
I didn't even think about the fact that the higher the degree of productivity that comes from it, then the higher the GDP growth rate, the higher the GDP growth rate, ultimately the tax revenues are going to follow that growth rate. So that makes a lot of sense. There's going to be a couple questions in this little one here. Currently, interest rates are in the low to mid 4% zone. And to me, 4%, lending my money to the government at 4.3% to the government doesn't really get me all wound up. But the other observation is that in the United States, we tend to have higher interest rates than most other mature economies, like European economies. It seems like higher degree of productivity. So the two questions become, one, do we have higher rates because we basically have a stronger nominal GDP growth rate than these other nations, and that makes a higher overall equity rate of return, and the bonds have to compete with the equities in some fashion? Does that make any sense? And the follow-on question is, how do you feel about loaning your money to the government at 4.3%? Or what does UBS think?
Yeah, I'll answer the last question first, and that is we've recently upgraded our view on treasuries to attractive, with the idea that this, you know, recent sell-off has made the return outlook for bonds relatively attractive now. And if we think about what's in a yield, and you were talking about different pieces indirectly, we have inflation expectations, we have real interest rates, and then we have different premium that can come from, call it supply, from the overall deficits and prior borrowing, and just how people perceive the hedging quality of bonds. The starting point is, yeah, U.S. yields tend to be higher than other developed markets. When you look at those different components, it makes sense because, one, as you mentioned, growth tends to be higher in the U.S., both in a nominal sense or a real sense. And in a real sense, yeah, we're benefiting from a higher productivity trend. So, in general, you make more money lending in economies where productivity rates are higher. There's an expectation you can earn more on your capital. And when you get to the inflation side, inflation experiences in the U.S. have been a bit higher than other developed markets. Obviously, Japan's on one extreme, but even compared to other euro area economies where the central banks have one focus, and that's on inflation, and they have tended to target inflation at a cap of 2 as opposed to the US, where we've moved to an environment where they think about target inflation as something around 2, maybe a little bit above, a little bit below, and we have to take into account where unemployment rates are as well. So we tend to have a higher inflation backdrop in the US for a couple of reasons. One is the bank is focused on a little bit of a different mandate. And so those two things together explain some of it. And then I think looking ahead in the US versus other markets, the term premium might be a little bit higher for a couple of different factors. But putting it all together, we think it's a good time to invest in treasuries. And I think you're also alluding to the fiscal outlook. And I think that's partly why the term premium in the US is relatively elevated. That is the extra money that you're earning above cash over the same horizon. And that term premium reflects there is a lot of US debt out there. The expectation is that it continues to rise and investors want to be compensated for that. And so we think that's in the price today. And I think to your point about equities, something I think that's relevant is today, the recent correlations have gone back to being negative for bonds and stocks. That is, bonds look like they can hedge stocks, but that's something that's always very important for investors to monitor, and that is, do bonds help hedge equity risk? And I think you also alluded to the fact that if investors can get a really high return on stocks, does that tend to compete for demand for bonds? And I think the underlying thing that's going on there is that if growth is strong, and that tends to help earnings and tends to help returns. And I think that's also in the price in terms of why interest rates could be higher in the US. Common factor might be that one.
You know, there was this concept over the last 6 months or a little longer of the end of American exceptionalism, and people were moving money out of the US markets and into foreign markets. And to a certain extent, I mean, the undervaluation of the foreign markets was so extreme that it made some sense. But for so long, watching the rest of the world markets, especially the European markets, the US has done so well for so long. Maybe that interest rate differential is indication that rates of growth, maybe growth and inflation, but are going to continue to be higher in the United States than our Euro brethren, so to speak. Maybe there's some good news in there somewhere.
That's about why the US has been such a source of capital. Is, you know, rates of return on both bonds and stocks have been better, and that attracts a lot of money.
If you were me, can you think of any other questions that I should ask you?
We've covered a lot of ground, and I'm just trying to think about other things that we could think about. I think, honestly, Mark, we covered a lot. It'll be an interesting time just to see how fast this supply shock evolves and then where interest rates go from there, and also how the fiscal outlook evolves, you know, in terms of do we need to spend a lot of money, extra money more than we anticipated, or do we see a change in the fiscal patterns compared to where we are right now? It's an interesting time.
Yeah, it sure would be nice if our politicians and Congress would do something to slow down their deficits. It doesn't seem like it'd be that hard. I mean, it seems like there's things they could do. Only problem is if they actually do them, they probably are afraid they won't be back in office again.
The incentives and the environments where it happens tend to be a number of things have to come together. I think the good news is we have a lot of precedent where they do come together, and we see some fiscal adjustments going back to the early 2010s or the 1990s. But it's something where the conditions have to be right, and right now they're not in place.
Yeah, well, eventually they will be. I mean, the free markets will be the arbiter of that one at some point. So, Professor, since I can't think of anything else to ask you, I just want to say thank you again very much, Andrew. I really appreciate having access to brilliant people like you and your willingness to share your thoughts with everybody today on the call. So, Andrew, you're awesome. I really appreciate it.
Oh, Mark, thanks for having me. I enjoy the discussion, and we can do it again. We can follow up.
That'll be great. Look forward to it. Thanks very much. Well, everybody, that concludes our Econ 101 class for the day. In summary, I have to admit that some of that was a bit confusing. Some of it went over my head, so I'm sure you're kind of feeling the same way. But nonetheless, a lot of it to me actually sounded pretty darn hopeful, especially the part about the American exceptionalism. So I look forward to speaking to you again next month. And this is the end of the Newport Legacy Podcast for this month of April. Thank you very much, everybody.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.